day on Against the Grain. 100 years ago, the U.S. entered World War I. What that war spawned was many things, but one of those things was resistance, was a popular movement against war and for peace. I'm CS. We'll present portions of a recent event examining past and present efforts to promote peace and disarmament coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. April 4th, 2017 was an interesting date. Exactly 100 years before, on April 4th, 1917, the United States Senate voted to enter World War I. Exactly 50 years before, on April 4th, 1967, Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. gave his most famous anti-war speech at Riverside Church in Manhattan. And so, on April 4th of this year, a distinguished group of anti-war activists and scholars gathered in Washington for an event called Remembering Past Wars and Preventing the Next. The event was sponsored by World Beyond War, the Center on Conscience and War, and Code Pink. And today we present portions of four of the talks delivered at that event, which took place at Busboys and Poets in D.C. You'll hear from David Swanson, director of World Beyond War, and the author of many books, including War is a Lie; Maria Santelli, executive director of the Center on Conscience and War; and Rainer Braun, a German peace activist and co-president of the International Peace Bureau. We begin with Michael Kazin, professor of history at Georgetown University and author of War Against War, The American Fight for Peace, 1914 to 1918, which was published earlier this year. Here's Michael Kazin.
First of all, important to remember that World War I was every war is a tragedy, but World War I was, if anything, more tragic than most, because unlike World War II, unlike Vietnam, none of the belligerents who got involved in that war, Tsarist Russia, Britain, France, Imperial Germany, Austria-Hungary, the Ottoman Empire, others, really wanted to fight. None of them really expected the war to happen. In fact, the very day that the Archduke and Archduchess of Austria-Hungary were killed by a Serbian terrorist on the streets of Sarajevo in Bosnia, German high command of the Navy was having dinner with a celebratory dinner with the high command of the British Navy in the port of Kiel, and they drank a lot and they toasted the health of the Kaiser on one hand and the King on the other hand, and then a month later, a little more than a month later, they were of course mortal enemies. Now the war was, as former President Barack Obama put it about the Iraq War, a stupid war. It was a war in which different empires were battling for position. They all thought it was a defensive war. Of course, they all decided they would have to go on the offensive in order to win this defensive war. And in the end, 17 million people died. 17 million people died. That's why it was called the Great War, and it's still called the Great War in Europe. Well, how did the United States get into the war? In general, Woodrow Wilson was ambivalent about getting into the war in many ways. He wanted to make sure the Germans wouldn't win, because he thought Germany was a tyrannical country, even though they had an elected legislature, the Reichstag, in which the Socialist Party was the largest party. On the other hand, he thought that Americans, especially in 1914, 1915, when the war began, the first year or so of the war, did not want to get into the war. It's very clear they didn't want to get into the war. And in fact, there was a peace movement, which I write about in the book, which was mobilizing quite effectively to try to convince Americans that there was no need to have a huge army, the size of the German army, the British army, the French army, or the Russian army. America had no interest in fighting this war. But gradually, through a complex process, which had a lot to do with the Germans using submarines, this frightening new weapon, to try to equal the odds against the Royal Navy, the British Navy, which is far superior on the high seas, U.S. Ships were torpedoed. Americans on British ships, like the Lusitania, the famous passenger ship, torpedoed in the spring of 1915, were killed. And gradually, Wilson decided that in order to protect American rights to trade with the belligerents, the British and the French, because it was impossible to trade with the Germans because the British had blockaded the North Sea, the only sea route to Germany. In order to protect America's freedom of the seas, he had to get into the war. And also, Wilson was an idealist, you could say a naive idealist. And sometimes naive idealism leads to repression, because if you feel you're right and everybody else is wrong, and they should follow your lead. And Wilson went from being seemingly a friend of the peace movement in 1915 and 1916. He ran in 1916 for re-election on the slogan, "He kept us out of war," which meant he kept us out of war against Germany and Austria-Hungary, as well as he kept us out of war against Mexico, where there were some skirmishes in 1916 on the border. But once he decided the United States had to get into the war, he decided everybody he had been somewhat sympathizing with in the peace movement, who often met with him in the White House to talk about what they thought he should do to mediate an end to the war in Europe, all these people should have gotten with the program. He decided to go to war, and therefore everyone should go with him. Some parallels to George W. Bush are there. But unlike George W. Bush, he acted on his hatred at this time, or hostility or animosity towards the anti-war movement, and he convinced Congress to sign two of the most repressive laws in American history, the Espionage Act of 1917 and the Sedition Act of 1918, which were actually amendments to the Espionage Act. Well, without going into all the details about these acts, they basically made it illegal to oppose the war, illegal to oppose the draft. Leaders of the anti-war movement, like the famous anarchist and feminist Emma Goldman, went to jail for organizing a no conscription league and holding rallies, not saying, you know, destroy the draft physically, just opposing it, thinking that it was a form of slavery. Eugene Debs, the most popular socialist in American history, though you might include Bernie Sanders these days, went to jail for giving a speech at a socialist picnic in Canton, Ohio in 1918. And what did he say in the speech? He basically said, war is bad for the working class, which socialists have been saying for decades. But he said it in 1918, and he was given a 10-year sentence. And there are many more examples of that. I think someone's going to talk about conscientious objection, right, later on. Conscientious objection was a new idea at the time, and it was very controversial, and it was very difficult to qualify as a conscientious objector at the beginning of the war. It got a little easier towards the end of the war. So there was a very large anti-war movement I write about in the book, and one of the things I think it's important, I think it's maybe has a lesson for the resistance against Trump today, too, is that you had a lot of different people, a lot of different ideological backgrounds and belief sets who were involved in this war. Some of the leaders of them were Dixiecrats, white supremacists who've been repressing blacks from voting in the South, like a guy named Claude Kitchen, who was majority leader of the South, Robert La Follette, who was one of the people who supported the NAACP when it was founded, and was very much sort of on the left fringe of mainstream American politics. He was a Republican. You had the whole Socialist Party opposing the war. You had feminists and suffragists until war was declared. Most suffragists opposed the war as well. So it was a broad coalition. It's what later on, 1930s, would be called a popular front. Now one can argue, people on the left, as you know, argue all the time about, you know, should you have certain people in the coalition? Shouldn't you have certain people in the coalition? You had, you know, black activists willing to work in a limited way with white supremacists who often weren't willing to work with them. And you had feminists willing to work with, you know, guys who clearly didn't want women to vote. But they had one thing in common. They thought the war would be an absolute disaster for the United States. And that's why they opposed it. And they were pretty confident, actually, they had the people on their side. And this is an interesting side that most people don't realize. The actual vote in Congress 100 years ago was pretty lopsided in favor of going to war. There were six senators, only six senators, who voted against going to war, including the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, by the way, a Democrat, a guy named William Stone from Missouri, and only 50 congresspeople, 49 men, one woman, the only first congresswoman in American history voted against the war as well. But this is pretty small numbers, of course. They were far outnumbered. However, the peace movement was pretty confident that they still had a majority of people on their side if only those people could be heard. And so the main tactic that the peace movement used in the last couple months before war was declared in February and March 1917 was democracy. They said, let's hold a referendum, a popular national referendum on whether the United States should go to war or not. This, of course, there's nothing in the Constitution to allow that. Congress would have had to okay it. Maybe President Wilson would have had to okay it as well. So it was a long shot at best, and of course it never happened. But they were afraid, the Wilson administration was afraid that this actually might happen, or if it did happen, they were afraid that it would be a very close vote, and they might even lose it. And in several dozen congressional districts around the country, congressmen did hold referendum of their own. Now, you know, they were anti-war congressmen, so not surprisingly, they came out lopsidedly against going to war. But it's important to remember how divided the country was at that time. As divided it was during the Vietnam War, as divided it was in the early days, at least, of the Iraq invasion in 2003. Because, you know, we often forget how influential peace-minded Americans have been in American history at different times. They very seldom have won. That's obviously true. Everyone up here knows the sad history of a failure of peace movements. But they often feel like they're close to winning. And to understand how they organized, why they thought they could win, I think is important. A couple things that you might not know about the peace movement, or the peace sentiment, I should say, during World War I. First of all, there was a draft for the first time since the Civil War. And if you know anything about the history of the Civil War, the draft, it was very unpopular, both in the North and the South. And it seemed at first that the draft was going to be obeyed by most young men. There was a registration of 10 million men on one day in July 1917. And, you know, the Army was able to get the people it wanted for the most part. And in fact, the United States only fought in combat, American troops only fought in combat in France for the last 6 months of the war in any serious way. And most Americans who died in one battle at the end of the war, a battle in eastern France, the Meuse-Argonne. So, there would have been more anti-war sentiment if the war had lasted longer, most likely, but it was pretty short for the United States. But one of the things about the draft was that a lot of people did resist it. A lot of young men did resist it. Thousands of men went to Mexico, not just Mexican-Americans, going back across what was then a very porous border, but people of different races, men of different races. Also, 3 million young men didn't register at all for the draft, as they had to do. 350,000 men refused to show up when they were called, who were registered. And there was all kinds of stories about draft resistance, which I won't have time to go into, but one of the most intriguing ones, though it also failed. Anybody ever hear of the Green Corn Rebellion? Anybody out there ever hear of the Green Corn Rebellion? Oklahoma, at the time, was, believe it or not, one of the most left-wing states in the country. Yes, indeed. It was a red state, which means something different back then than it does now. 17% of voters in Oklahoma in 1912 voted for Eugene Debs for president, the socialist candidate. And socialists won various little towns, one control of little towns, one called Antlers, Oklahoma, for several years. And many of the socialists and labor unionists and the industrial workers of the world, the radical labor union at that time, who were so opposed to going to war, what they thought was a rich man's war and a poor man's fight, as they put it, that they organized a armed group to march on Washington, to get to go to Congress and try to stop them from prosecuting the war. Well, they weren't well organized, and they were stopped by a larger force of police and militia, and they never got outside the Mexican. They never crossed the Oklahoma border into Arkansas, but it shows you how much rage there was in a place where we don't really think of as a pretty radical place today. In fact, Barack Obama didn't win one county in Oklahoma either times he ran in 2008 and 2012. So anyway, we should remember World War I as the first of many what you might call wars of choice that the United States has fought. Wars that the United States did not have to fight, that there had no self-interest in fighting, and that arguably hurt a lot more people than it helped. And if you think about that, one of the intriguing, or perhaps not so intriguing, but horrifying elements of American involvement in World War I was U.S. troops made the difference in the Germans losing the war. Not by fighting a battle, because as I said, there was only one big battle in which American troops fought, but 2 million American troops got to France by the summer of 1918. The Germans and the French and the Austro-Hungarians were exhausted. There were mutinies going on in these armies. The Russians were mutinying, and the Bolsheviks were gaining, partly because they wanted to get the Russians out of the war. And the Germans, you know, just could not fight against 2 million fresh troops. So they unleashed a couple really final offensives in France in the early summer of 1918. And when they lost, it was clear they had lost the war. It was called an armistice, but it was a surrender, in fact. Well, think about what would have happened if the Germans had not lost the war, if there had been a negotiated settlement, or even if the Germans had won the war. This was not Hitler, by the way. It was an authoritarian government, but with an elected legislature, which had a lot of power, though it didn't have power over the military. Without U.S. troops, you probably don't get World War II. At least you don't get Hitler. So the best of intentions that Wilson actually had, and many Americans who'd supported the war actually had, to make a world made safe for democracy, as Wilson put it on April 2nd, 1917, ended up perhaps, it's counterfactual, but perhaps leading to the worst war in history, even worse war than World War I.
That's Michael Kazin, Georgetown University history professor and author of War Against War, The American Fight for Peace, 1914 to 1918. He spoke at an event called Remembering Past Wars and Preventing the Next. It took place in Washington, D.C. on April 4th of this year. Another featured speaker was Rainer Braun. Rainer Braun is a German activist, a veteran activist for peace and disarmament, and co-president of the International Peace Bureau, a global peace network. You'll hear Braun refer to a talk by Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., by which he means the anti-Vietnam War speech delivered by Dr. King at Riverside Church in Manhattan in 1967. Braun also refers to the $54 billion hike in U.S. military spending proposed by Donald Trump in March. Here's Rainer Braun.
When I was reading again the speech of Martin Luther King, preparing a little bit the evening today, first I was thinking, it's a U.S. speech. He's speaking about Vietnam. But when you read it really carefully, it is absolutely an international speech, which is a speech to the whole world. And I would like to underline this first when I speak in some sentences what Martin Luther King was calling or naming extreme materialism. 85 people of the world, the richest 85 people, have the same income than 3.5 billion people of the world. And 110 people of the world own or have a richness of $81.1 trillion. In the same minutes of this richness, 1 billion people has to live with less than $1.25 per day. This is extreme materialism. This is extreme ownership and property. And I think 15 years later, we have, in the sense of Martin Luther King, we have to ask the question, what has this to do with capitalism? And can this world coexist with a capitalistic system in the future? I have the deep feeling that we cannot avoid any longer this discussion. But let me come from this point to the peace point with a very nice quote from a socialist who was killed in July 1914, Jean Jaurès, a French socialist and peace activist. He said this wonderful sentence, capitalism and wars are together like clouds and rain. They are deeply depending from each other. And when we are looking to the situation today, you know, 54 billion additional money for the military budget in the United States. This is the same amount of money which is the whole military budget of Great Britain and which is more than the military budget of Russia now. It is 53 billion. And they have to reduce this because of their low income for oil and gas for 2018 to 48 billion. That is the reality. And when we are discussing this reality, we have to say, The world is spending every year $1.7 trillion for military purposes. $1.7 trillion. You know, we had in the year 2016 a conference in Addis Ababa, and clever politicians and people and scientists were sitting together and discussing for 1 week how we can pay for the sustainable development goals. The first very positive point of the last years was that the United Nations adopt these sustainable development goals, which means we want to get rid of poverty, hunger, we want to have clear water, education, healthcare system, better environmental conditions for all people in the world, and reach this aim in the next 20 to 30 years. But these cost about $300 billion per year. And these guys were sitting together 1 week, and at the end of the week they say, we will meet again next year, without any solution. But it is so easy to say how we can pay the Sustainable Development Goal, how we can pay for the Green Climate Fund of the United Nations, which we so urgently need for getting some solutions for the huge climate challenges. We have to reduce the military budget. That is the easiest answer of the world. But the militarization of all these, the military industrial science media complex, stop this, and we have to overcome these politics. And let me add one figure which is so extreme that it is really difficult to understand. You know, all the nuclear weapons countries are modernizing their nuclear weapons. All nine which up to now have nuclear weapons. This should cost for the next 20 to 30 years $1 trillion. Now, every one of you knows when the politician and the military industrial complex now said it costs $1 trillion, it will in the end cost in the minimum $2.5 trillion, at the minimum. So that is alone for nuclear disarmament should be spent in the next years. And this is not any longer possible. But I will not only speak about horrible figures for the future. I have also can also speak a little bit about hope when I'm speaking about nuclear weapons. For the first time in history, in the last week at the United Nations, 128 countries were sitting together with the peace movement and other social movement, and starting developing a treaty for ban and for prohibit nuclear weapons. We never had this in history. This is such a great step forward. And it was done after a long process developed together from peace movements and governments. And these 128 governments, this is the big majority of the country. And it was symbolic that we were sitting in the big hall at the United Nations, and your stupid ambassador at the United Nations, together with more stupid 15 other ambassadors of the nuclear weapons countries and some of the NATO countries, were staying outside and were saying, no, 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 we cannot take part. This is the wrong way. Their way is very easy. Their way is modernization and even use of nuclear weapons. So this is a hope. This will not make the world immediately rid of nuclear weapons, but this could be a very important step of stigmatization of nuclear weapons, of developing new norms, and create new worldwide coalitions. And now the last 3 minutes to NATO. NATO is the biggest military alliance in the world. NATO surrounded Russia. NATO was against the will of the people, and international negotiations marching from 1990 to 2003 to the east. This is absolutely dangerous. Additionally, we are creating a missile defense system at the border to Russia. NATO is spending $800 billion per year. It is the biggest military alliance in history. For what? For the poor Russia with the $53 billion? For dominance of the Western countries, for their economic resources, for profit. And so we have to overcome NATO when we really want to keep and developing peace. So Please go home and inform your people in the States about how dangerous is NATO and that there is really no reason to have NATO in the future. NATO is one of the biggest obstacles for developing a peace process in the world, and we have alternatives. The name of the alternatives is common security and disarmament. And for all of this, we need what, and I think all of you will remember this quote, what the New York Times was naming on the 16th of February 2003, the second superpower peace movement. Why she was doing the New York Times doing this? Because this was the day after 50 million people marching all around the world for peace and against the Iraq war. We have to go this way again. There is no alternative to this, and I'm happy that you start with big actions on the 20th and 21st of January. Let us put our forces together. Let us engage again more people in the peace movement, better and broader coalition building on both sides of the Atlantic, and with all the new powers in the world, this can really fulfill peace and disarmament, what we need that our planet can survive.
That's Rainer Braun, a German peace activist and co-president of the International Peace Bureau. We'll take a short break and then return with portions of two other talks delivered at an event entitled Remembering Past Wars and Preventing the Next. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Today, we're presenting portions of four talks delivered at an event held on April 4th of this year called Remembering Past Wars and Preventing the Next. We turn now to Maria Santelli. She is Executive Director of the Center on Conscience and War and Founding Director of the New Mexico GI Rights Hotline.
So on November 11th, 1918, fighting ceased and what was called the Great War at that time came to an end. Armistice Day was intended to be marked every year in honor of world peace. It was the war to end all wars, but of course it didn't. And for the last century, we have continued, we have moved forward in almost a continuous state of war to this day. That November 11th holiday was edited to reflect this common state of perpetual war in 1954, and we now know it as Veterans Day, meant to keep our focus on the war and the warrior, overshadowing and perhaps even erasing the promise of world peace and the experience of conscientious objectors in World War I. After that war ended, after the First World War ended, there was some debate on whether the horrifying accounts of the brutal treatment of the men who refused to kill were real. The talking point at that time was that conscientious objectors were treated with leniency, but the truth was recorded in letters, diaries, and family and community histories. It was also entered into the congressional record on March 4th, 1919, in testimony provided by the National Civil Liberties Bureau. Quote, at the United States Disciplinary Barracks at Alcatraz Island, Alcatraz, that's where we kept our men who refused to kill other people, at Alcatraz Island, California, four religious objectors, three Hoffer brothers and Jacob Wipf, were placed in a perfectly dark dungeon where water seeped in from the sea, their outer clothing removed, and where they were fed only small amounts of bread and water. At the end of the fifth day, they were removed by recommendation of the medical examiner and placed in isolation. Later, they were transferred to Fort Leavenworth. Two of those brothers died of pneumonia within 10 days of their arrival. The body of one of these men was sent home dressed in the uniform of the United States Army, although he had gone to prison because of his refusal to wear that very uniform. it eventually became clear to their jailers that no amount of abuse, torture, humiliation, or ridicule could force the conscientious objectors to compromise their beliefs in any way. So why go to such lengths to punish a person who will not fight? Why try to coerce a person into denying their most fundamental values and principles? The answer is that the violence of war is not natural for us. It must be taught and it must be continually reinforced. The inevitability of violence and injustice is a myth that persists at the hands of media and government who choose to strengthen their own influence and harden their own power by sowing fear and division among our communities. It is a myth that is reinforced subtly, like by changing the name and purpose of a federal holiday, and it is a myth that is reinforced aggressively by drill sergeants. In our work at the Center on Conscience and War, the stories of the conscientious objectors that we work with serve as daily reminders and individual case studies that prove that humanity is naturally predisposed to peace. Our conscience tells us that cooperation with one another is right and that violence and injustice against one another is wrong. In a time when it feels like the military and the culture of violence have colonized so much of our lives, our land, our economy, our culture, and in so many cases, even our churches, there is one part of us that cannot be colonized, at least not permanently, and that is the conscience. And that fact poses a great threat to the ability to make and perpetuate war. Presbyterian minister and conscientious objector Norman Thomas wrote about the objectors in World War I. Quote, "This insignificant fraction of the youth of America challenged the power of the state when it was mightiest and the philosophy of war when it was most pervasive. They said, you may kill us, but you can't make us fight against our will. They said it not as men who court martyrdom, but as men who serve principle. Not as those who despised the state, but as those who refused to make it God. If enough of them had said that thing in every land, there would have been no war." And that is the thing that the military and the state know very well. And it is evident in the lengths that they go to try to make our kids into killers. Basic military training is a science that has been expressly designed to circumvent the human conscience, to teach a soldier to kill by rote, reflexively, without thinking, and without filtering through the conscience. We have to be programmed to kill. If it was natural, it would come easy for us, it would be good for us, and we would thrive after engaging in it. But that's not the truth. The hundreds of thousands of veterans that we know are suffering from the wounds of moral injury, wounds to the soul caused by a transgression against the conscience, are proof of our tragic misunderstanding of our own nature. With deep gratitude to the sacrifices made by the conscientious objectors of a century ago, the COs of today don't have to choose between violating their orders or violating their conscience. They have a third choice, applying for discharge, a choice that allows them to follow their conscience and seek justice. In the years just preceding the U.S. entry to World War II, that's when our organization was founded, and we worked to influence that generation's draft to include real, enforceable protections for conscientious objectors. There would be no more court martials, there would be no more torture, although the emotional and sometimes physical abuse does continue of people who resist. During the draft years from World War II and forward, COs could perform civilian service instead of being forced to perform support roles for war or go to jail. Pentagon policy modeled after that 1940 draft law still allows modern COs in our all-recruited military to legally apply for discharge as conscientious objectors. And many individuals do just that, especially now when even the lowest ranking private can easily observe that we are seeing a clear move toward an even more over-militarized approach to foreign policy than the United States' already over-militarized approach to foreign policy. In our organization, between 2015 and 2016, we experienced a 62% increase in the number of conscientious objector cases that we work with.
That's Maria Santelli. She is Executive Director of the Center on Conscience and War. And that group sponsored, along with World Beyond War and Code Pink, an event held in Washington, D.C. called Remembering Past Wars and Preventing the Next. I'm CS, and this is Against the Grain, and we turn now to David Swanson. Swanson is director of World Beyond War and the author of many books, including War is a Lie and When the World Outlawed War. Here's David Swanson.
I love going to places like London, England, where they have monuments honoring conscientious objectors. I think this town could use one. Instead, they're working on a World War I monument and an Eisenhower monument and, you know, 18 other war monuments to add to the collection here. The calculations that we sometimes do about this budget and about recent wars, you know, they did these after World War I as well, and I should have looked up the statistics, but it was dramatic things like could have built a house for every person on Earth. And one complaint was, what did we get out of it? We got out of it the flu epidemic and prohibition. And that, you know, nothing more. Well, but I think we got many, many serious things out of World War I, including the permanent military-industrial complex and the taxes and expenses to go with it, including the whole propaganda model that has been used to sell U.S. wars ever since. You guys know who the Four Minute Men were? It took them 4 minutes to change a reel in a movie theater. So they filled those 4 minutes by having some jerk get up and tell you how evil the Germans were and how important it was that you pick up a gun and start killing people. And the use of religion was there, the racism, that with Germans being another race, the fear-mongering, the demonization, the glorification of violence, the strategic narrowing of the options, so your only choice is violence. You know, everything that I wrote about in my book, War is a Lie, was to be found there in that propaganda campaign that has been refined and improved and advanced ever since. But essentially it was there with World War I. We also got this package of attacks on civil liberties that come with all of these wars for freedom. The targeting of dissent, the secrecy that's now used as a justification for everything in the U.S. government, the Espionage Act that President Obama was so fond of using against whistleblowers, and the groups that push back, the ACLU and these organizations that push back on civil liberties, but never on war and never on the military spending that creates the problems, they come out of World War I. The carving up of the Middle East for British and French and later U.S. imperial interests that has done such wonders of good over the past 100 years. World War I. Perhaps it's a little obvious, but the biggest and worst thing that we got out of World War I was, of course, World War II. And that military-industrial complex that came out of World War I went right on arming, and arming both sides of the future wars. And you also got the advantages for veterans after World War II, which came out of the activism of the veterans of World War I, the bonus army that marched on this town after World War I and was attacked with chemical weapons by the future heroes of World War II. And, you know, this is why veterans after World War II were treated a little better, because they didn't want that again, not because it was a better war. I'm reading a book about weapons dealing and reading about this character named Basil Zaharov, who was one of the early big weapons dealers. And in the Balkans, where that assassination happened that was the trigger for World War I, in the decades leading up, violence was kept stirred up in that region by these weapons dealers who would bribe editors to push for war, who would bribe border guards to fire shots, who would bribe governments to buy weapons. You know, so many weapons for the past 100 years have been bought not because anybody wanted them, not because any evil ideology or warmongering enterprise demanded them, but because somebody was getting bribed and it was profitable. You know, this question of which comes first, the weapons or the wars, it is the weapons. It is the weapons that come first. And we know this with the almost open conversation in this town now about what the hostility toward Russia is all about. You know, they just almost openly admit that it's about profit. Whereas after World War I, you couldn't say that in public. I mean, the idea of profiting from war was shameful in the decades that followed World War I. And, you know, the reason that this wonderful thing is happening at the United Nations with these meetings last week that Reiner mentioned, sitting down in an open public forum with 130-some countries ready to ban nuclear weapons, why is that possible? Why are people saying, this is what I've wanted the UN to look like since it was created, and it never has up until now? Because the big five permanent members of the security complex, plus Germany, aren't there. They're out of that picture. You know, and these are the arms dealers of the world. These are the weapons dealers that arm Africa. And we think of Africa, or we think of the Middle East, we think of these regions as being inherently violent. Well, they wouldn't be inherently violent with weapons of war if somebody wasn't pushing those weapons of war on them. They aren't made there. They're made here, first and foremost, in the United States. Which also arms both sides of most current conflicts. I think that public referendum idea that the peace movement pushed, that Michael talked about just before World War I, and that was almost put into U.S. law in the decades that followed World War I, was a wonderful idea then and is a wonderful idea now. And this institute at the University of Maryland that showed people what the current federal budget is and then ask them, what would you do with it? Because you can't just poll the U.S. public on the budget. They don't have a foggiest idea what it looks like now. But showed them what it is and said, what do you want to do? The vast majority of this incredibly ill-informed, poorly educated public wanted to take $40 to $50 billion out of the military. Whereas Trump's budget wants to do the exact opposite. Right? So there's actually a 90-some billion-dollar gap between what the public would do if you let a representative group of the public govern and you know, call it something like, I don't know, democracy, and what Trump wants to do, you know. And of course, what Congress will do if we don't stop them, which is, you know, go half or two-thirds of the way toward what Trump wants to do. The other thing we got out of World War I that was absolutely wonderful and has to be revived was an incredibly powerful peace movement in the years after World War I, when the people who believed the, you know, war to end all wars nonsense and the people who didn't were all collectively agreed on, let's make it true now. Let's end all wars. Let's be done with this. And, you know, you had movements for disarmament that failed dramatically. You had the push for the League of Nations that, of course, in this country failed dramatically. You had efforts at building better relationships among the nations that generally failed. But you also had this push that came from a lawyer in Chicago initially and got all the peace groups around it to ban war. Because up through World War I, wars weren't illegal. They were thought of as like the weather. They just sort of happen. And after World War I, this idea was, well, you know, by itself it won't end wars, but let's start by drawing a line and saying war is illegal. We banned dueling. We didn't ban just aggressive dueling and keep humanitarian dueling. We said, this is barbaric. Let's be done with it. Well, let's ban war for group disputes, as we've banned dueling for individual disputes. Let's be done with it. And so they did. And they created the Kellogg-Briand Pact, which was ratified by the United States Senate the day after Martin Luther King Jr. was born in 1929. So for all of Dr. King's life, except when he was less than one day old, war was illegal. And it has been illegal ever since. And looking back at the peace movement and the strength and the moral arguments and the organizing that it did in those days is of even more value than pointing out the existence of laws that are on our side. I was looking at Martin Luther King's speech as well and what people have said, and I don't know if you remember a guy named Jay Johnson who was at Homeland Security, and then he was a lawyer at the Pentagon while Obama was president. And he came out and told us that now, today, if Martin Luther King were alive, he would support all the U.S. wars. Right? And apparently believed this, and apparently worked among people who believed this. Right? And I looked at James Mattis, the Secretary of so-called Defense now, who gave a speech on a Martin Luther King holiday a couple of months ago, who said nothing about Dr. King opposing wars, of course. You know, he's just a civil rights guy. You know, he has nothing to do with opposing wars. Nobody, you know, has to be told that. But said, when it comes to civil rights, the U.S. military was out ahead of the civil rights movement, because you just look back to the Lewis and Clark trip across to scout out genocide across the country, and they allowed a slave they had brought along to have a vote on whether to proceed across some river. So don't talk to us about civil rights. You know, this is the climate we're up against. You know, this is the culture that we have to reintroduce these ideas from this brilliant speech of 50 years ago into. Yesterday was also the anniversary of something done in 1948 called the Marshall Plan, which cost a tiny fraction of what it cost the United States to continue killing people and producing famines and starvation and making everything worse and making this country hated around the world. It was a minimal cost, but the idea was not only prosecute war as a crime because of the Kellogg-Briand Pact, you know, one-sidedly just prosecute the losers, but also don't do what was done after World War I in terms of intentionally beating the hell out of the losing country in hopes of producing another world war. Let's try something different, right? This is an idea that we have to bring back today. And when we start looking at what it costs to do everything wrong, to make everything worse. You know, the extreme materialism, the extreme inequality we heard about of the concentration of wealth among the billionaires and so forth is nothing. It's a drop in the bucket compared to the money spent on the military year after year after year with the United States, yes, spending over 10 times what Russia is spending on the military, and Russia decreasing it as part of its sneaky, evil plot to dominate the world, right? And it would cost tens of billions to end starvation, to end diseases, to end the lack of clean drinking water, right? So it is this financial expense that kills more than any weapon, more than any war. It is a financial drain. It is this enterprise is the biggest destroyer of human rights, the biggest eroder of civil liberties, the biggest demolisher of the natural environment, of our air, of our earth, of our water. And there are alternatives to it that have been developed over the past 100 years and over the past 50 years and just in recent years, that we don't need systems of war. We don't need structures of violence to have a structure of laws and economics and culture that handles disputes by other means. Right? So these are the choices we have to start imagining, what we could have and what we could give the entire world for the amount of money that is being spent on the U.S. military. I would just mention one other issue that I think we really have to understand and deal with in the coming weeks and months related to the conscientious objection and resistance to drafts, and that is that the Democrats are going to keep pushing even harder in the U.S. Congress to compel every 18-year-old young woman to register for the draft like every young man has to do, and not in order to be cruel to them and force them to sign up to join a criminal enterprise of mass murder and risk their lives, you know, but to defend their rights against the injustice, the unfairness, the discrimination against young women of not forcing them to register for the draft for selective service. So we have to come up with a better understanding of what feminism is and a better understanding of why the draft is not actually a good thing for the peace movement. You know, this idea, oh, we need a draft because then people will hate war. No, come on. We have 6 million dead bodies to go with that draft, We haven't had anything that bad since then. A draft is not a humanitarian tool. We need to come up with an understanding of why and how to oppose this and to stop it and end this idea of expanding the draft as a progressive move.
The voice of David Swanson. He's the director of World Beyond War and the author of many books, including When the World Outlawed War. He was one of the featured speakers at an event called Remembering Past Wars and Preventing the Next. It was held at Busboys and Poets in D.C. on April 4th of this year. And we have time to bring you one more clip of Maria Santelli. Here she is speaking during the question and answer period.
We're able to perpetuate war. We're able to carry out war because we have this misguided notion that, you know, that war is necessary and that war is inevitable. But then we also have decided collectively, or let other people decide for us, that some portion of our population is expendable. You know, and so your boss, who went to the Air Force, who was in the Air Force Reserves, she was lucky. If she was really doing well and she was really earning money and not losing money, she was lucky. You know, most of the reservists. We also work on the GI Rights Hotline, so we don't only talk to conscientious objectors, we talk to people who actually like are trying to make a go of it in their military service and are having struggles doing so. And I can say anecdotally, of course, no question, I talk to more people of color who are getting screwed. I can say, of course, anecdotally, I talk to more enlisted people than officers who are getting screwed by their military service. Reservists lose money. You know. Typically, they don't. It isn't another source of income. You can't go to school. It's very difficult to go to school. Your first thing that you lose, if you get anything less than an honorable discharge, and that doesn't mean you get a dishonorable discharge. That means you just simply get a general under honorable conditions. You lose your GI Bill. So the number one reason why people join, they lose immediately. A lot of times, they lose those benefits because of some act of misconduct, some transgression that they commit because of their trauma. And trauma doesn't only come from combat service. Trauma comes from military training. You know, Trump's budget to increase military spending, there is a small cut in the DOD. And does anyone know what it is? What's being cut in Trump's DOD budget? Healthcare for active duty. Yeah. Members, healthcare, you know, so decreased healthcare, more boots on the ground, less protection of civilians in drone strikes, you know, all of these things are going to add up to have more people traumatized, more people being kicked out, more people experiencing homelessness, poverty, violence. 20 suicides a day among veterans, one suicide a day among active duty members. Every single day, one active duty member. More people have taken their own lives in the U.S. military than have been killed by ISIS, right? So we have to fight that idea that some portion of our population is expendable and talk about these things as part of our anti-war work. Obviously not the only piece, but part of our anti-war work. The recruiting budget already, which is, you know, $1 billion every year, gone down from $20 billion during the height of the Iraq War, but about $1 billion every year, is going to increase just for the Army $300 million in order to give kids in high school, 17-year-olds, bonuses to enlist while they're still 17. They're not even out of high school yet, and they're signing up to enlist.
Maria Santelli is executive director of the Center on Conscience and War. I want to thank Wilton Vaught and Other Voices, Other Choices for furnishing the audio of the event, which was edited by yours truly. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said. And we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.